When I was a 21-year-old college student, I got pregnant. I didn't want to be. I had no money to raise a child, no support from my family, and no real option other than abortion. In some ways, my abortion did not feel like a freely made choice, though it was a choice I was so grateful to have in a world that hates mothers and children and that punishes pregnant people with poverty. The clinic workers were kind and dedicated, but they were clearly overworked. The clinic was crowded. I felt scared and unprepared for my abortion, and I was not allowed to have a support person with me. There were men screaming at me outside the clinic. It was a bad experience. A bad experience I felt grateful to have because it is an experience now denied to so many women. I have never regretted my abortion, but I have long regretted the political climate in which women have abortions. Now, it's even worse, as women must travel to seek abortions if they can seek them at all, and that's a big if. It's so clear to me that the point of all of this is to punish us as women, no matter what our choices are. Becoming a mother is wrong. Having an abortion is wrong. Existing as a woman in this world is forever wrong, and they will punish us no matter what we do or what we don't do. Hi, I'm Zahn Valines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood Podcast. Just a quick reminder before we get started that you can support this podcast by sharing it on social media. You can also leave a positive review on your favorite podcast platform. And those little heart reacts on Substack actually help a lot. They bump me up in the algorithm. As a lot of you know, social media is actively engaged in a war against feminist and leftist creators. They push us down, they make us less visible, they promote right-wing hate speech. And the most effective way to push back is to give the algorithm what it wants, which is engagement. So if you can share, if you can comment, if you can engage, that is a great gift to this podcast that allows it to continue. If you have $8 a month to spare, I would love it if you became a paid subscriber. You'll get a bonus podcast. You'll get access to a support group. You'll get the satisfaction of knowing that you're supporting this podcast. But if you can't or don't want to do that, you're doing enough by listening, and I'm so glad that you're here. This month, October 2025, if you're binging sometime in the future, I'm experimenting with a new model. I'm doing a podcast every week instead of my usual twice monthly schedule. I want to see if this pace is sustainable for me and if viewers like it. So I'd love your feedback on whether you like the more frequent podcasts and whether they've sustained the same quality. So please let me know in the comments. Also, I am just so excited about our guest today, as I told her before we started recording. I literally squealed when her people contacted me, and she's wonderful, and I think you're going to think she's wonderful too. Marlene Gerber-Fried is a longtime reproductive rights activist and scholar. She was the founding president of the National Network for Abortion Funds and the Abortion Rights Fund of Western Massachusetts. Currently, she is professor emerita at Hampshire College, where she taught for 37 years. She is senior faculty advisor to Collective Power for Reproductive Justice, serves on the board of Women Help Women, and co-chairs the Bo Our Bodies, Ourselves expert panel on abortion and contraception. She edited From Abortion to Reproductive Freedom, Transforming a Movement, and co-authored with Yael Silliman, Elena Gutierrez, and Loretta Ross, Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organize for Reproductive Justice. Her most recent book, Abortion, Reproductive Justice, An Essential Guide to Resistance, co-authored with Loretta Ross, has just been released. Marlene, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's a real honor to have you here.
Zahn, thank you so much for having me. Loretta regrets that she couldn't be here. We're very excited to do this. And as you know, as I told you, this is the first podcast about the book. So it's really special and important.
Well, I think it's a great book. I actually just finished it last night. So I want to start by talking about the book. Again, it's Abortion and Reproductive Justice, An Essential Guide for Resistance. And I feel like it's exactly certainly what I needed to read right now. My own work has included a lot of activism for maternal health and safer birth options. And I feel like too often this doesn't necessarily intersect with abortion, even though they are part of the same continuum of healthcare. So I'm just really grateful for the reproductive justice model that you and Loretta Ross speak so eloquently to. And I think that's obviously what frames the book. So talk to me a little bit about the book and the expansive vision of reproductive justice it offers.
The vision, which we did not create, but was created by 12 African American feminist activists who were at a conference on choice and discussing the Clinton healthcare bill, and were found the conversation at that conference lacking. And so they came together and created this idea of reproductive justice. And since that time, it's really women of color who have taken the lead on inspiring and igniting a movement, developing the theory and the concept. But it's for everybody. I mean, it's not a concept simply only for women of color. I mean, simply, I mean only, but it's a concept for all of us. And the thing that you read in the beginning really makes clear the need for thinking about abortion in this broader lens. I mean, manipulating women's reproduction is a project that implicates white supremacy, it implicates racism, it implicates eugenics. All the systems of oppression come together in the efforts to regulate abortion. So, in terms of thinking about why did we do this? Why did I took so seriously this question of who do we need another book on abortion? And so I really just try to over and over think about what is it that is important for us to say? What hasn't been said? And even though the idea of reproductive justice existed long before it had language for a lot of people, abortion kept being a single issue, just taken out of context of all other human rights and reproductive and social justice issues, which of course doesn't make a lot of sense when you think about all the interconnections that are involved. So I think that while we had an immediate impetus for writing it, which is that we started, the idea for this came during the first Trump administration, where we were watching what appeared to be a tsunami of threats to abortion, and increasingly more dangerous and more extreme. And of course, it's only gotten worse. And we were especially struck by the fact that 53% of white women had voted for Trump in both elections, both of his elections. And at the same time, we understood that for a lot of women of all races, keeping abortion legal was important. So there was a disconnect between how people felt about abortion and who they were voting for. So, with all due humility, we thought, well, maybe people just don't really understand how much abortion is embedded in the story of race and white supremacy. So we really need to write that story so that people will know it. And for a lot of activists, even in the movement, we don't know our own history. We don't really know about, but we're responding always, all the time, we're responding to threats. So in those all those ways, it was very important to us to try and think this through. After so many years of our own activism, we have been co-conspirators for a long time in this movement. We first wrote something in early 1990s, abortion and reproductive freedom. That was how we just thought about it. But for new generations of activists who aren't schooled in a history of reproduction. And anyway, where would you learn that history? Especially now when all such truths are being suppressed. So we really wanted to present to people a way of beginning. And it's really meant to be a beginning. This is a book, it's meant to introduce people. That doesn't mean it's simplistic. It doesn't mean it's basic. It is a complicated analysis, but it doesn't rely on your already knowing a lot of things. It tries to explain what you need to know, what the tools for understanding are.
I love that. And I love having something that I can send listeners to because I feel like there's kind of this disconnect where books on abortion are either, as you said, sort of simplistic. They're arguing for why we need abortion, or they assume a ton of background knowledge and they're extremely academic and make reference to things that a lot of people have never heard of or about. So I think this really fills that niche nicely. I wanted to ask you about the white women who voted for Trump. I mean, I know that we already give them a whole lot of attention, but the thing that really sticks out to me is that I've been writing about abortion for years, and every time that there is a Democratic candidate who's running anywhere, who's anti-choice, I've always written about it. And the feedback that I've always gotten until recently is this is a small thing to focus on, and of course Roe v. Wade would never be overturned. And where did that, why did people think that? Where did that come from?
Well, I was one of the people who thought that, but for the reason that there was no need to do it. They were chipping away at whatever rights Roe v. Wade gave people. So I thought, why bother if you're on the anti-abortion side? You're getting everything you want anyway. Which I don't think is what those people who said that to you meant. I think the sort of general wisdom was that people don't vote on what they think about reproduction, which of course may really be proxy for people don't really vote on women's rights. So I think that those ideas are deeply embedded in our culture and deeply embedded in terms of how seriously do we take people who can give birth's rights to be able to control their own bodies and their own whether or not they're going to have children, which of course is what reproductive justice is all about. It's not just the right not to have children, it's the right to have children. And putting those things together in the same frame, which is part of what the reproductive justice lens on abortion does. It says you can't just look at one side of this because if all you focus on is the right not to have children, then that leads very quickly to population control, eugenics, to forcing some people to be sterilized against their will. So if you really have an expansive liberatory framework, you have to look at both sides of the reproductive coin.
Well, and I think there's also there's such a close connection between abortion access and the ability to have children. So I live in Georgia, which has the worst maternal mortality rate in the country and higher maternal mortality than like I think it's 100 other countries. And we have had 3 children, and I would really like to have another one, but my partner and I decided that it just wasn't safe because what if something went wrong? What if I needed an abortion? What if we had to travel? We cannot risk depriving our current children of their mother. And I hear that from a lot of women making those decisions.
And this is not just ringing alarm bells that are made up. I mean, we know already that that people are dying from these laws, that people are being deprived of the ability to have use conceptive technologies like IVF. So we already have so much information. It's not like, oh, if we could just gather more data. I mean, we have the data that we need. And I'm thinking a lot these days. We're almost at the anniversary of the Hyde Amendment. Not every anniversary is worth celebrating, but the truth is that it's important for us to remember how we got here. And how we got here, of course, is a very long story beginning in colonialism and the effort to make the country, a white supremacist country. But in more recent history, just 3 years after Roe v. Wade, Congress passed the Hyde Amendment, taking away public funding for abortion. Before the Hyde Amendment, people could get their abortions paid for under certain circumstances. Since the Hyde Amendment, almost no one, maybe 200 people a year. The first person known to have died from an illegal abortion after the Hyde Amendment was Rosie Jimenez, and we're also coming up on the anniversary of her death. She was a single 27-year-old single mother in Texas. She was worked in a factory. She was a college student. She was pregnant, and she knew she couldn't have another child. So she took what she felt was her only option, which was to have an illegal abortion, and she died. Now, the Hyde Amendment should have told everybody that the courts and laws are not protecting everybody's rights. But here we are, 49 years later, the old story, but the enduring troops, trips, sorry, enduring truths, which is that anyone who is already vulnerable because of other forms of oppression, and it's not just about abortion, make it more dangerous. Having children is incredibly more dangerous, especially for Black women. And this is not a story, Rosie's story is not a story about one person. Hers is a story about how things work in this society.
Yeah, well, and the other thing that I like to highlight is we talk about these tragic stories of women who have died, and we talk about the statistics, and it's easy to read headlines and lose sight of the fact that these women are people, and that anytime someone dies, an entire world dies with them, an entire world of possibility and opportunities, and one death is too many. I want to talk to you a little bit about wealth inequality and how that intersects with all of this, because I know you worked with the National Network of Abortion Funds for years and years and years. So I think the statistic is something like 50-ish percent of women who seek abortions, their primary reason is economic. And then there was a 2018 study that found that 76% of women seeking abortions said they did not have enough money to cover housing, transportation, and food before getting pregnant. So clearly, we're seeing women are being pushed out of having children that they might otherwise have and pushed into abortion. And abortion is expensive. So they're also being pushed out of abortion. And now that states are banning or limiting abortion, pregnant people must bear additional massive costs, time off work, travel, paying for childcare for multiple days. Talk a little bit about how the bans are exacerbating all of these issues and what you're hearing and seeing.
So I know that it's not everybody is not pushed into the same camp. So people who live in economic insecurity are being pushed out of having children. And that's, of course, a very old story, going back to sterilization abuse, going back to decimating Native American peoples. So the who gets who's going to have the privilege, and it's not supposed to be a privilege, it should be a basic human right. Who will have the privilege of being able to have children? Is these laws are guaranteeing that it won't be white middle class and upper middle class people. It won't be people who have economic advantages. So that's one piece of this kind of yucky scene. I think the other piece of it is that more and more people are vulnerable to the insecurities that are coming with these bans. More and more people are being forced, as you said, to travel if they can, to raise money if they can. I mean, back in the day, people had to rely on friends and neighbors to help them. There were no abortion funds, and the abortion funds themselves are under tremendous threat by, laws like the ones in Texas that encourage turn people in, anyone who helps anyone get an abortion. So the things that I guess I'm hearing are somewhat stories like yours, but mostly to have us all stand back and say, for all these years, abortion is thought of as choice, but what is it a choice? Is it a choice if you don't, if all you can do is not have a child when really you would rather have a child? So I think if what we're going for is a world in which people get to make the best decisions for themselves and for their families about having children, how many children, when to have them, under what circumstances, we are getting farther and farther away from that world, which is, of course, not to say that every person who has an abortion would rather have a child. I think that's the other kind of flipping of the script that the anti-abortion people want to do, is that, under any circumstance, any person would rather have a child than an abortion. We know that's not true. We know that people have many complicated reasons for not wanting to have a child at a particular time, just as they want for having a child at a particular time. So to go back to the thing that you'd said, which is real people in real life situations, and which is of course part of what was problematic about the whole choice versus life debate. There's no nuance in it. There's no, it's, it has nothing to do with how most people live their lives. Which is that you're trying to decide how it fits into a much more complicated life. I always think that in every story of abortion, there's a story. It's like a microcosm of an entire existence. And nobody, in the abortion funds, nobody ever just had the problem that they couldn't afford an abortion. It was part of education and housing and job security and family needs. So to try and isolate abortion does not make sense in the context of how we all live our lives. I hope that came close to answering what you were asking.
Oh no, that definitely answers it. We talk a lot about choice and keeping abortion legal. But I think my opening vignette touches on something, which is, what does a better, more expansive vision of abortion look like? When I was pregnant with my first child, my parents have a friend who is in her 80s and who was a big abortion leader and ran some clinics and was always part of the movement. And I remember her going with me to tour the birth center where I was going to have my daughter. And she said, "Oh, we used to do abortions at places like this." My head might as well have like spun around backwards. I was like, "What? You did it all in one place?" And just like, "Oh, and there would be a woman who would hold your hand, and we'd talk to you." And it was a vision that was just completely unfamiliar to me and to my generation, because now we're just not even hoping to keep abortion legal, but at this point clinging to like even some women being able to have abortions sometimes. So I wanted to get your thoughts on, we're always kind of in this defensive posture of clawing back as much as we can. But what would a better world for abortion look like? Obviously in my mind, I have a vision of, full spectrum reproductive health care and like birth centers, but there's all kinds of lovely ways we could make it better.
Indeed. And there was for a time in the 60s and 70s, late 60s, 70s, there were these feminist women's health clinics, which, as you say, were delivering feminist health care. The Jane Collective did abortions, but they also taught you how to look at your own uterus and how to demystify what was going on and learn what was going on with your body. Billy Avery, who was the founder of the National Black Women's Health Project, one of the things that she created in Florida was a center that for both birthing and abortion. And just that same caring and understanding that you're on a continuum of care. So I think that the more expansive vision of abortion is a vision that keeps it in place that keeps that also allows. One of the abortion funds is called All Options, and it's in Indiana, and it provides support for pregnancy as well as for abortion. And that's, if you ask me, that's more walking the walk and talking the talk of reproductive justice and abortion, and not just we'll help you get an abortion, but after that, you're on your own if you're not getting one. So, I think that we could, I'm hoping, I always have hope that we will do better, that we will have a more liberatory future. In which abortion and having children and not having children, it is something that people appreciate as a continuum of care and not as a either or. Because we know that most people who have abortions already have children. So it's not an either. I mean, again, the anti-abortion people want to create, construct a mental world in which there are two kinds of people, the people who have abortions and the people who are kind and compassionate and loving and have children. And we just know that that's not true. Truth is in short supply these days, but that important truth has got to be told over and over again. And one of the ways that, of course, activists have done that is by having people tell their stories, by having women speak out about their having had an abortion. And of course, that takes courage. The more abortion is under attack, the more courage it seems to take. And these days, in a world of extreme violence, it's quite frightening. But it's, and we're also not equally positioned to take those risks. And so, appreciating that as well, not being frustrated by people who won't step up in that way because they can't. So for those of us who can, that's what we need to do. And it will provide cover for other people.
I love that. I remember, I think it was around the end of Roe v. Wade, there were a lot of social media posts urging women to step up and tell their abortion stories. And some of them had kind of a shaming tone of, if you're not telling your story, you're being cowardly. And what I thought is, why aren't we asking men to tell their abortion stories? Because, we're saving men with this too.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this idea that do women always have to do it? Do women have to bear the burden of the oppression and then at the same time be the only people who are fighting to get rid of the oppression? I think that's part of what this is. But I also think that it's critically important for people, even if you're not going in the public sphere, but just in your own spheres of friendship and family, to tell your stories. So many people don't know what their own family history of reproduction is. Many people have had the experience of finally being told, well, Aunt so and so or your grandma had an abortion. And again, the shame, I mean, the shame of having an abortion, the shame put on people by society, the shame of keeping it a secret, the shame of not telling, all of these ways in which women especially are shamed by society for not fitting a certain image of what a woman should be.
Absolutely. And those stories, they're often presented in sort of like hushed, shameful tones. I have a good friend whose grandmother died having a botched abortion. But she had a number of daughters before this happened. And she obviously has my friend as a granddaughter. And so every year on Mother's Day, my friend tells this story of, think of how much more my grandmother could have given and done if she had had access to safe and legal abortion. And I just think that's really lovely and a beautiful way to memorialize her grandmother.
Yeah, I love that and I hate that. It's bringing a tear, of course.
It's hard not to, but those stories are so important. So I'm going to tell you what gives me hope, which you might think this is a little strange, so I want to get your thoughts on this. So I think the latest statistic says that 64% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases, and about 90% say it should be legal in at least some cases. So the extremists who want to ban abortion are an extreme minority, and yet they spent the last 50 years fighting for something that was deeply unpopular and that a lot of people thought they would never attain, and they just kept going. They organized, they built solidarity, they worked with people they hated otherwise to just doggedly win this fight and impose their will on the rest of us. And I think the lesson from that is that it works to keep fighting, because I think that it seemed hopeless to them for many, many years. And then all of a sudden it worked, but it required like 50 years of discipline.
And of getting control of the major institutions of healthcare and justice that are criminal justice, the courts. So it does. I remember when the decision for gay marriage came out, and somebody was interviewing a priest, and they said to the priest, "Well, I guess you feel like this is the end for your movement, the movement to only allow heterosexual people to be married." And the priest smiled and said, "Well, no, actually not, because it's taking all these years to overthrow Roe v. Wade, to get to Roe v. Wade, and we're going to get there." And similarly, that gives us hope for turning back gay rights. So, what you're saying is, well, let us keep that hope on the other side and see the possibilities here. We know that we can't, you never know if you're going to succeed. And on the Good Trouble Day of Action recently this summer, one of my favorite state level politicians talked. She's a woman of my generation, and she's been fighting the good fight for many, many years. And she said, "Look, you never know that you're making history when you're doing it. You're just resisting. You're just fighting for what you think is right, and you have no choice but to do it." And again, I really agree with her, because none of us ever knew. We didn't know that we would have an impact on the war in Vietnam. We didn't know that there would be a Civil Rights Act. We didn't know that that abortion would become legalized. And just so we didn't know that it would be undone. And I used to think, I can't believe we're still fighting these fights. But of course, you see that history is not a straight up trajectory. So the people who are opposed to human rights and social justice aren't going to give up when they lose. It's like those cults that believe in the end of the world is a certain date, and then it doesn't happen. And what happens? They just get even more resolved that the world is going to end. So the people who are on the what I would consider the wrong side of history are not giving up, and we can't either. And for me, I've been an activist since I was a much younger person, and it's shaped my whole life in positive ways as well. It's given me community. It's given me a moral compass. So I don't think of it as a burden. I think of it as a privilege to be able to fight for justice. I mean, one of the things that Loretta always says is, fighting against fascists is difficult, but fighting for democracy should be fun, or something like that. Basically, we should grab a hold of the arc of history, which is not, unfortunately, just going to bend all by itself towards justice. It needs us, all of us, to be pushing on that arc.
I love that. One of the things that my mom used to say is that we get free over generations, and you do as much as you can, and then you pass it on to the next generation. I had a friend this morning who posted on Facebook, and or she's been advocating for her transgender child at school, and it's gone poorly. And she posted something along the lines of, all this rage used to be hope. And I said to her, I actually think the rage is hope. And, I think that's, I think you're feeling that rage because there is always going to be hope as long as you feel it and you push on. So you mentioned a lifetime of activism, and I want to ask you about that, because you've been doing this for longer than many of my listeners have been alive. I am 40, and so I've been doing this for a little while, but not nearly as long as you. And I got to tell you, I already feel tired. Feminist activism can be really demoralizing, and I think that there are a lot of dynamics in this kind of activism that make it harder than it needs to be. But we have to sustain hope because that's the only way we keep going. I'm sure that you've been through many cycles of demoralization. What have you learned about keeping this going for a lifetime and just continuing to press on? How do we sustain a lifetime of feminist activism?
I think you need your community. You need your people. We're still aware of who is not with us, but we need, and your people don't all have to be activists. They can be the people you listen to music with, or the people you cook with, or the people that you go to play sports with. But you need your community, and you need to be able to have some balance in your life. I was thinking there was a time when I went to a meeting every single night. I don't know why my children didn't divorce me, really. But there's some way in which you might need to pace yourself to do it in ways, because you know that you're not the only one. I mean, if you're the only one doing it, there's something wrong with you and with that movement. So, and you're not. You're as your mother said, you pass it on. But even in the moment, you're activists with a lot of other people. And I also think that it's very important to celebrate the wins at whatever level. And part of the work of the abortion funds came out of a feeling that, you write a letter to a congressperson or you make a phone call and it's just into the stratosphere, didn't do anything. But at the end of the day, in the abortion funds, some people got the abortions they needed and wouldn't have otherwise. And we never lost sight of that, of the importance of every single person. So you could say, oh, what's the impact? What are the big numbers here? But an individual person is an important number of one. So I would say that. I would say that also for me, doing this work and learning especially about our own history of activism. So we have a friend, colleague, who's also at Smith College, who has this project called The Roots of Reproductive Justice. And it's a timeline of 500 years of reproductive justice activism. So I always say, well, if you think you're tired, think about that. But it's cool. I mean, it's devoted to telling the untold stories, to lifting up the things that we don't know of people who resisted, sometimes as individuals, sometimes as part of a social movement, but they just didn't put up with it. And we know this from enslaved women, people who live in really in other countries who are living in under even worse conditions than we are. So I think that's where I get inspiration, is from thinking about ordinary people. My friend Laura Kaplan wrote the what I believe is the only book on the Jane Collective, and she says we were ordinary women living in extraordinary times.
That.
It wasn't like we were amazing.
Yeah.
Time made us amazing.
That's a really beautiful sentiment. So you telling you sharing this has reminded me of a story. I love the idea of connecting with feminist history and with our ancestors, because I recently had this really profound experience where My great grandmother, I didn't really know anything about her as a person, and kind of didn't really think of her as a person in the way I think of, the people that I know, because it's easy to get distanced from other people. And then I started doing some genealogy research, kind of like not really for any reason, just to pass the time while I was nursing a baby. And I looked her up and I found her first voter registration card. And I just like immediately burst into tears, feeling so happy for her that like she got to register to vote. And it's she's dead and gone, and the joy that she felt about that is dead and gone, but like something about that lived on and made me realize like, okay, that was her fight. I hope it doesn't become mine, but if it does, we'll do it.
That's such also a precious memory. I mean, the importance of those documents. I mean, it's important to document what people who did and to have whatever we can preserve of those struggles. And I was also thinking about voting. Like voting is not all there is, blah blah blah. I think it was Patricia Williams who once said, "The right to vote, it's only not important to the people who already have the right. For people who don't have that right, it is critically important." And I remember when apartheid was overthrown in South Africa, and when people actually got to vote, people of color, and sometimes people waited in lines for 3 days to vote. What a struggle means in a is really contextualized in a particular moment, in a particular country, in a particular time. It kind of gives me the chills often to think about that what people have done that have has seemed so impossible. And I know this is a hard time, like how do we keep the hope, to go back to the question that one of your listeners had raised. It is hard. And the idea that hope is a discipline, I feel like hope, you have hope muscles. You have to like exercise them all the time. Otherwise they will become flaccid, and just like all your other muscles. But the idea of holding on to hope is the only thing that'll keep you going. Otherwise you'd just be, it wouldn't make any sense. Like, why do these things if they're not going to produce anything? So I still have hope. I still think that things will change back. Burning it down, as we're learning, is not hard. The Republicans and Trump are showing us that it's just so easy to tear it down. And yeah, I remember I often would, in my classes, I would talk with students about how can we make things better. They burn it down, get rid of everything. Yes, go. But of course, we wouldn't ever burn it down this way. I mean, this is just like a way of, without any care for people or what things mean. So it's going to take a long time to build it back better. But I think we will be able to. I mean, with abortion, for example, since Roe was never enough, Roe was never what we wanted. We needed abortion access. It's one of the only countries in the world where it gets to be an abortion law, and there's no provision for helping people pay for them, get them. So now we know that's not a good way to proceed. And if we fight for getting abortion back, we better fight for access. If we're fighting for the rights of pregnant people, it better be equal. It better not be that the mortality rates for African American women are skyrocketing. And some of the ways in which we've told the story is if it's always been as if there's one story, but there isn't. There are the stories that are shaped by our race and class. And it's just painfully obvious as we go through history how this is, it keeps raising They never stop raising their ugly heads. But I'm hoping we'll learn from that.
Yeah, I think we can. I love this idea of hope as a muscle. I'm gonna write this down. I'm going to put this on scraps of paper and cover my house in it. And I'm not even remotely joking. My kids are going to very much tire of hearing that very soon.
I hope they become a physical therapist so they can help people take care of their hope muscle.
Oh, I have. My kids are little, but they're already activists in a way that just gives me so much hope for the future. And all of their friends kind of are too.
That's so.
These little people are going to save us.
Yeah, and they're also going to stress you out
Oh, God, yes.
because they're not going to, they're going to question your authority too. And hard as that is, that's what you want.
Yeah. It's funny because my toddler was up literally all night last night. Sometimes they do that where their brains just get out of control. And it's like you're doing the deep breathing and trying not to get mad and trying to be the parent that you want to be. And at some point I was really starting to lose it. And then I listened to her and she was singing all these songs to herself about friends have empathy, care about people who are different, like all of these just really nice messages that she's repeating to herself at 4 a.m. And I thought, well, if she has energy for these messages at 4 a.m., that's pretty good. Like we're doing well.
Yeah, that's really great. I love that. And I'd love to hear her singing.
Well, I may have to, hopefully she will not be up at 4 a.m.
Yeah,
again
I don't want to
tonight.
hear it at 4 a.m.
Hopefully she will not afford me an opportunity to record her tonight, but she's pretty intense, so she might. It could happen. Speaking of children, you mentioned people asking about children, and when I asked listeners about their questions for you, I got a lot of like very specific questions, but overall the theme was, I have a daughter and I'm scared, and sort of like what do? And you could almost like in the writing of the questions, you could see them getting more frantic, like as the writing went on, just thinking about things. So what do you tell this generation of parents about how we can just manage to not lose our minds looking at our kids' futures?
Yeah, a former student of mine who worked on our book with us for a while at one point looked at me and said, "You just don't get it, Marlene. My generation doesn't know if we will even have a future." So back to the mu hope muscle there. And as we've been talking about in the bigger picture, people really do need to continue to resist and fight and whatever. But how to keep your sanity in all of that when you're thinking of your own children and family? I'm really committed to the spreading of information about abortion pills outside the formal medical system and the formal legal system. So I feel like that genie is not going to go back into the bottle. And but the problem is that many people don't know about them. They don't know how to get them. They're pretty cheap, so you could, in some places and in other places not. So I guess for me, I want to make sure that everybody knows that there's no need for anyone to die from an unsafe abortion. There's just no need anymore. The tools exist. Rosie Jimenez lived in a time when those tools did not exist, but the tools are there. So to spread the word, which is also empowering. I think there's a project here, which sends abortion pills to states where there are bans. And, people, volunteers come once a week, pack them up, send them off. And I think, again, like the abortion funds, feeling like you can actually implement some change before the big change. The big change is going to be a long time off right now. I don't think I'm gonna see it in my lifetime, but these other smaller changes that keep people going and alive, really, because these issues of reproduction are life and death matters. Both, the pregnancy and abortion and contraception and. So, to kind of be able to participate in keeping people sane and healthy is probably the best we can do.
Well, and that's not small. That's
Oh,
something.
exactly. It's not small. And I think we sort of come to think, I mean, the craziness of the moment we're in is as the Republicans rip everything apart, it's just like, oh, wow, how are we going to fix that? And first of all, I think they're overreaching. So let's remember that. I think it's hard to remember in this moment when the right wing is on the ascendancy and patriarchy and the death of democracy are like really just right in our faces all the time. I think it's hard to remember that I don't believe most people want that world. And I think the more they get of it, the less they're going to want it. And I think that's what we began to see with the attacks on abortion in the States. People don't like them. People don't say, oh, that great, that's exactly what we want. I mean, there are some people who do like them, but these are minority positions. And I don't believe that minority positions forever can hold sway.
Yeah, I agree. I think you're right. I hear a lot of people saying we're already on our way to Nazi Germany or it's inevitable. And the thing I always say is, well, okay, even if that is inevitable, Nazi Germany no longer exists. There's another side that we can get to.
Right. And but I think it's probably important also to, I don't want to say embrace, but take that in. I mean, we don't want, are we the good Germans? Like we keep saying, oh my God, I see this train of totalitarianism coming down the pike, and I don't know what to do to stop it. And we're like the man in Tiananmen Square holding up his hand against a tank. That's what it feels like a lot. But I also think it's important to be clear-sighted that there is an end game of authoritarianism, and we don't want that. So I think people need to see it and appreciate it. In the first Trump presidency, a lot of people thought he was a joke. They didn't take him seriously. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's bored. He's not, This time around, none of those messages can be comforting or accurate at all. And so we need to take seriously how big the threats are and at the same time not be daunted by that. So, we have to also work our not being daunted muscles too. There's a lot of body work here.
It's a full workout. There's so much to do, and I already have this exercise thing that I'm doing, and now you're telling me I've got at least two more muscles I have to work on.
This we're gonna call this beyond the stationary exercise bicycle.
Love it. I love it. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to leave it. Marlene, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Oh, thank you, son. It's been great to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for your decades of important work.